What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Let's have some fun with a little Q&A episode. I have plenty of questions that are left over from Instagram, so thank you to everybody who asked me a question. We've had some really, really good guests on. We have another good guest on. I think we have a guest episode. I'm sitting at my computer. We have Dr. Emily Dow tomorrow. We have Alec Blennis next week. We have Jordan from Barbell Medicine in a couple of weeks. And those are some really good guests, so I'm very excited for those. But in the meantime, we'll drop you a Q&A episode, which is always fun. Let's kick it off. Reminder, I don't look at any of these questions beforehand. We're just off the old cuff. All right. First question. I'm wondering if you could interview Kelsey J. Fitt on your pod. That's so funny. That's our first question. She is proof you can transform your body to look like you lift, but not being bulky and heavy looking. Would love the two of you to talk about this. Yeah, we can absolutely talk about that. But and I've known Kelsey for a long time. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. But I just the thing that jumped out to me immediately when I read the question was like, everyone's different genetically. Like, you could do everything that Kelsey does and you would look different, right? You can only apply principles to your own genetics. And that doesn't mean that like you have no control over certain things with how your body is shaped or what muscles you grow more than others. But yeah, you know, I think if, and again, we can have this chat, but I would want you, the listener or question asker, to know that you could do all the things that Kelsey does and not necessarily look like Kelsey does. And I would say that Kelsey works her absolute butt off. And so it's not even the fact that people do the work and don't end up looking like Kelsey. It's because they probably don't do as much work. You know, someone who's tracked and lifted and bulked and cut and bulked and cut many, many times to look the way that she does. And yeah, she looks great. So yeah, I would be happy to chat with her. I'll put her on the list of podcast guests and we can talk a bit about this. Next question. I strength train 3 times a week and I have time for 3 30-minute cardio sessions per week, but only have a walking pad. Would you suggest 1 harder session per week of circuit style, kind of high knees, et cetera? Basically what you're saying is something higher intensity that's not on the treadmill or not on the walking pad, and just to make one of those sessions harder for those benefits that you'd get from higher intensity. I think this is a good idea. I think you're coming to a smart conclusion, which is like, hey, I think doing 3 30-minute cardio. First of all, let me just be upfront. Let's start with this. Lifting 3 times a week and doing three times a week cardio of any intensity is incredible. It's amazing. You are checking a ton of the available boxes. I'm so proud. I'm so happy. This is a high level of fitness. This is not a little bit of training. You're doing a great, amazing, amazing job. So when I say that you are acknowledging that there is a unique benefit to higher intensity cardio, I'm not saying uniquely better than low intensity. I'm just saying there are things you can get from higher intensity cardio that you don't get otherwise. And similarly, to some degree, from lower intensity cardio, I'm not saying one is more special than the other. I'm just saying they have unique benefits and, you know, doing either will give you those benefits. So the short answer is kind of, you know, I can't get away from the fact that doing some sort of session like this, where maybe it's something like high knees, maybe there's burpees involved, maybe it's some sort of, you know, just calisthenics in place to keep your heart rate a bit higher for higher intensity, mountain climbers, like whatever. I can't shake that I'd personally not enjoy that, but to park my enjoyment to the side, I think there's some merit there. I think if you'd be open to going outside, you could accomplish this fairly within 30 minutes easily with running. Like, even if you did 10 rounds of 1 minute harder run with 2 minutes of walking, right? That's 30 minutes. I think you'd check this box wonderfully. I think that to me, that feels more practical. And you might say, okay, well, for some reason in your circumstance, that's not as practical, or you might not enjoy that. And you might prefer a more in-place calisthenics sort of circuit style. I'd say the circuit style stuff on a very technical level has some downsides depending on what movements comprise such a circuit. I think it would be still a fine idea if you came up with, you know, 5 exercises that you could rotate through quickly that aren't, you know, that you're not getting. The thing you'd want to avoid is getting muscles really close to failure, right? That would make this sort of Metcon circuit slightly less good is if you're getting individual muscles very close to failure, we would want, you know, one of the things we want with cardio is what's called a high cycle rate. So it's like a lot of repetitions over time. And it's like running, you do like, again, a ton of steps, you know, Stairmaster, elliptical, there's a ton of, you know, quote unquote repetitions. If you think about a bike, every cycle through is a repetition. You get thousands and thousands of reps. And, you know, what that can do, especially because it's a lower intensity, can give you some of the benefits like increased venous return, help the heart fill up more, which is one of the adaptations that you'd be looking to get from cardio. Anyway, you'd be getting that from incline walking, right? On your cardio pad. You didn't say incline walking, but I suspect that if it goes on an incline, that's one way to get yourself into zone two without needing to run. So long story short, you could do this. I wouldn't enjoy it. I'd probably get outside for like, you know, a slightly higher intensity run session. Of course, I'm saying that because I like running. You might not. Again, even if you had an exercise bike, I think an exercise bike is perfect for this stuff. You know, 30 seconds all out or 30 seconds really hard. And then, you know, two and a half minutes of steady pedaling and you do that 10 times. I think that would be better. Again, both of those involve, you know, not your question. So yes, I think you could do this. I would find that between the downsides and my lack of enjoyment, I would seek out some other way to do that. But yeah, cool. Next question. How long should I bulk for? Eating 200 calories over maintenance. I weigh myself daily, but not exactly sure how much weight I should be gaining. Super duper simple. I'm going to give you the super answer, and I'm sorry for the crude nature of how I'm about to say this, but you want to gain somewhere between, I would say, 0.5% and 1% of your body weight per month. If you're 150 pounds, that's up to 1.5 pounds per month. Some people would correctly say, I'll admit, you could go even higher. You could go 1% to 2% of your body weight, which would for you would be 1.5, or this hypothetical person, 1.5 pounds, up to 3 pounds a month. So, you know, you could say somewhere between 0.5 pound and 2 pounds a month, and you just do that until you feel too fat and want to stop. Right? Sorry for the crude nature of saying that. There are going to be people out here who say, well, you should really, you know, you should only bulk until you gain so much weight that it starts to impact your nutrient partitioning and your insulin sensitivity. It's like, that's probably more than 0% true. But the funny part is like, you will stop your bulk because you feel uncomfortable before it becomes a health issue, you know? So a lot of people stop before your nutrient partition. It's like, yeah. That, I'm going to stop well before that happens because I'm not going to feel good anymore, right? Like I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to gain this much weight or I don't feel good in my body, etc. Those things are going to happen first. So you should bulk as long as you can sustain it until you feel like enough is enough. I don't want to gain more body fat. Now I will say the slower you gain tends to lead to slightly less fat gain. You know, let's say you gain closer to the 0.5% per month. You can consider a higher percentage of each pound gained to be muscle. That we don't know how true what I just said is. We don't know how much better the ratio is of muscle to fat gained per pound if you gain at 0.5 or at 1.5. But we do know is that if you gain slower, it tends to be that you're gaining a higher percentage of muscle to fat per pound. Again, that, you know, for non-bodybuilders, like regular people like you and me who want to do a bulk, I don't see why you wouldn't just go slow, you know, just go slowly, gain for longer, right? Be in a very small, very, very small calorie surplus, which by the way, 200 calories seems perfect for this. For a longer period of time, bulking is, you know, I'd say bulking, but like whatever, being in a small surplus, you feel great. Well, I don't want to make it seem like it's always just rainbows and butterflies, but it's a preferred physiological state, right? Like I'd perform better in a surplus, generally feel better in a surplus, generally have more life flexibility. So I'd rather be in a small surplus for longer. And again, if you add in the fact that you probably gain a little less body fat doing it that way, that's the way I would go. Now that sort of rate of gain is your North Star. You adjust your calories based on that rate of gain. You don't adjust your calories based on a weekly, right? Certainly not on a daily basis, not even on a weekly basis. I might not even judge on a monthly basis. I might look bi-monthly. So like so every 2 months, right? So it's like, hey, if you're trying to gain 1.5 pounds a month, then you might just zoom out and say, well, I'm trying to gain 3 pounds every 2 months. Because you might have a month where you gain a little less and another month where you gain a little bit more. And I tend to zoom out and want the dust to settle over a slightly longer time period before I make that call. Next question. What's the biggest benefit to eating beans? Protein, satiety, fiber, protein, satiety, fiber. I mean, beans are a good source of protein, a good source of fiber, right? Like, and those benefits have other knock-on benefits of like, that also makes them good for satiety. And then you could talk about what are the benefits of fiber, right? Improved gut health, you know, improved, let's say lower cholesterol. So, you know, from the protein perspective, more muscle mass, whatever. You know, so I think the biggest benefit to eating beans is that they are, in my opinion, a unique combination of protein and fiber. And that combination, I mean, if we think of what is everybody obsessed with right now, they're obsessed with protein and they're obsessed with fiber. It's like, all right, great. Yo, eat more beans. Eat more beans. You know, put beans with your rice. You know, put beans in your, with your, if you eat ground meat, you know, cut some of that ground meat and add beans. You know, I've been eating, you know, I'll just rattle off the top of my head how I've been getting more beans. Those are two of the ways. I've also been getting this white bean soup from Costco. It has like 12 grams of fiber for a cup of soup. It's like 12 grams of protein, 12 grams of fiber for a cup of soup. It's delicious. How else? We've been getting the frozen edamame from Costco. They come in like an individual packed bags. They're just incredible. We've been eating more of those edamame. They're like roasted edamame snacks. I was on Jordan's Side podcast and he had mentioned edamame pasta, which I just found out is by the same company that makes the edamame, the roasted edamame beans, the snack. So I just ordered some of those. I also think eating, you know, swapping out your regular pasta for bean pasta is a no-brainer, whether that's like a red lentil pasta or a chickpea pasta, or my favorite is the Brahmi protein pasta, which is partially from lupini beans. That's a really great way. Brahmi also makes a lupini bean snack, which is what I would say the single greatest set of macros you could ever imagine in a snack. It's not as tasty as the edamame, roasted edamame, but if you are looking for macros and satiety, then you can't go wrong there. I feel like I'm missing it. Obviously lentils, lentils in meat has been super easy. We've done blended lentils into a red sauce. So like putting a thing of Rao's in a pot and then putting some lentils and using some sort of immersion blender or putting them in the blender. You just don't taste it. You know, even putting in some peppers and some other things in it and just blending it up, it's been great. Also to help my daughter get some of that stuff in. Somebody listened to me on the Jordan Side podcast and she owns a bean farm and she sent me fresh beans because I had referenced that I don't cook my beans fresh. I just make them canned, which are great. And that's not what she's saying. She's not saying, oh, they're not good when they're canned. They're great when they're canned. But they own a bean farm. She was like, would you mind if I send you some beans? And so I said, no, amazing. She sent me four different kinds of beans and I've only made one of the bags so far, soak them overnight. And then I put them in my rice cooker. I will say, at first I was like, there's no way I'm doing this process. I'm not soaking them and then cooking them for an hour and a half. And then like that is not my MO. You know, the can is my MO. Crack it, drain it, rinse it, eat it. But I will say the fresh beans were really, 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 really good. They were they were worth it. They were worth, I know soaking, it's not a lot of worth, not a lot of work. And there are people listening to this like, gosh, you're lazy. And like, you're right. I am, but it felt worth it. And so I'm going to make, we made the black beans. She gave me fava beans. No, not fava beans, navy beans. And then a couple other beans, orca beans. If you've never seen them, Google them. They're super cool. It's like this like white and black pattern. And then a very similar pattern, but with white and brown. I forgot the name. But anyway, I'm excited to give those a shot. So I'll keep you posted. Next question. Also, before we move to the next question, if you're more interested in bean-related talks, go listen to the podcast I did a couple of weeks ago with Andy DeSantis. First of all, Andy's the man. He's a great follow on social media. Very passionate about what he does. And I think that's a great podcast. Towards the end, we start talking specifically about beans, but beans are, you know, pop up throughout the entirety of the podcast. Next question. Where do you recommend going for reading more articles? Where do you do your research? Yeah. So if you think about a hierarchy of information dissemination. So where does the top of that, let's say pyramid, is people doing direct research. That's not me. Then there are people who read loads and loads and loads of direct research, and then they will do some sort of research review. And it's like, okay, we read all these papers this month, and here's the breakdown of all those papers. I'm not that person either. I don't have a research roundup or a research review. I read direct literature all the time, but that's not what I find to be the best use of my time, we'll say. So I have many subscriptions to many, let's say, research roundups or research breakdowns, or the word is escaping me. Just things like Alan Aragon's Research Review, Mass Research Review, Examine.com has one. There are more. Why are they escaping me? But those are three that come to mind immediately: is Mass Research Review, especially from the exercise perspective, Alan Aragon's, which is a bit of exercise, a bit of nutrition, the Examine.com one is actually really, really good. And there are more, but it's escaping me at the moment. Those would be the three that I'd recommend here. Next question. If I only have 3 times a week, 60 minutes per session, what should I do to maximize this time? My main goal is building strength, but second is longevity. So I think because you have a longevity goal at all, I'd say that there should be some period of this time where you're doing cardio. But since your main goal is building strength, I'd spend, most of that time on lifting weights. And so, there's no perfect answer to this question without a collaborative discussion with you, but strictly off the cuff or just something to work on, I'd say, maybe you're doing 40 to 45 minutes of strength training out of those 60 and doing something like 15 to 20 minutes on the cardiovascular side after you're lifting. What's cool is you can do something like 3 times a week, 45 minutes, and if you have a good program, and I'm not just tooting my own horn, there are many good programs, but we have a 3 times per week program that is in this 45 minute-ish range that I think would work wonderfully. You can see amazing, amazing results if you have a good program and you train hard 3 times a week, 45 minutes. That is enough to see just life-changing strength and muscle growth. I say life-changing meaning like you just get all of the health benefits by far and improve your physical independence and your strength and your physique and all of the good things in that 3 times a week, 45 minute range. With the remaining, let's say 15 to 20 minutes, I would lean into maybe a slightly higher intensity cardio approach where you're doing, maybe you're aiming at something like 10 minutes of net high intensity during those sessions, maybe less, 6 to 10 minutes. And I think you can get by think you can get a good bang for your buck doing it that way. So something like, 5 rounds of 1 minute hard, 2 minute easy at the end of a session, that's a 15 minute workout. And honestly, every permutation has benefit. So let's say you have 15 minutes. Let's use that. 1 minute on, 2 minutes off, 5 rounds. That's 15 minutes. Everything from that up to 15 straight minutes hard is beneficial, right? You could do 4 minutes on, 1 minute off. So 4 minutes kind of more moderate, and then maybe like a 1 minute walk or something, air quote walk, because if you're using a bike or something, it's just like 1 minute easy. And you could do 3 rounds, 4 on, 1 off, 3 rounds. That's 15 minutes. You could do 2.5 minutes on, 2.5 minutes off. And you could do three rounds. Like every permutation is good for you, right? Is good for you. Everything all the way up to 15 straight minutes moderate, right? Like that's a totally high quality way to spend those minutes at the end of a session. I think that that's probably a better approach than doing like, hey, twice a week lifting, 1 time a week, 60 minutes. But I think you could do that too. If you were like, hey, I don't like doing both in a session. Can I do 2 full body training sessions and 1 60-minute cardio session? You can do that. You absolutely can do that. And in those 60 minutes of cardio, I would have some element of higher intensity in there. But of course, you're not doing 60 minutes of high intensity. So that is my advice. And I think you can see a really great outcome doing that. I think you're going to be, doing more than most, and you're going to see some really great benefits. Next question. What are your thoughts on having a meal time cut off before bed? Benefits? How long should the time be? So it's not complicated. When you are sleeping, you don't also want your body to be working hard on something. And if your body's working hard on digesting food, then it's probably going to come at the cost of some sort of sleep quality. You can answer this yourself, which is like, do I struggle with sleep? If you struggle with sleep, if you're like, I don't sleep well, one of the things of many that I would look at is, how late are you eating that last meal? What is that last meal, right? The closer you eat to bed, the smaller I'd want that meal to be because I want it to be digested by the time you go to bed. So my thoughts are that if somebody looked me in the face and said, I sleep great, I sleep 8 hours, 7 hours, I have no complaints, no issues, then I'm not going to fix a problem that doesn't exist because the problem is how this might impact your sleep. And if you sleep fine, and I know some people are going to be like, well, you know, when the sun goes down and you melatonin is higher, you're more insulin resistant and eating at this time. Okay, no problem. I understand the mechanism. But in the context of everything we do to be healthy, I'm not worried about this outside of how it impacts your sleep. I'm really not. Those mechanisms of reduced insulin sensitivity as melatonin goes up, I don't think matter nearly as much as whether or not this messes with your sleep. Now, I want to stack the deck in my favor in terms of sleep because there are some reasons why let's say less modifiable factors. Like when you have your last meal is more modifiable than some other things. And so if you can modify it, I might modify it to stack the deck in your favor. But there are some things that make it not modifiable. Your kids come home from practice and you have the only time to have family dinner is 7:30 and you want to be in bed by 9:30. So you only have this 2 hour window or even less if you're eating, you know, from 7:30 to 8:30. Like there are some parts of this that are not modifiable. So my thoughts are that it's one of many things you can do to very likely improve sleep to some degree, but I would take your own circumstance into account and also take in your own subjective assessment of your sleep habits. If you're like, hey, I sleep great, man. Like I sleep, no problems with sleep at all, which by the way, I say somewhat facetiously sarcastically, because most people wouldn't say that. Like most people have some yearning for better sleep. And so I don't want to throw this piece of advice away because I actually think it is on the list because it's fairly modifiable. Now I'll shut up here. My personal approach is roughly 3 hours before bed. I'd like to not have any food. And if I do, it's sips and bites, you know, like I'm not going to stress if I, you know, come home we went to the park last night until like 7:45. And my daughter kept saying she wanted a bean, like the edamame beans or something. She goes to bed like 45 minutes. So, okay, she had a few. And of course, you know, when you have toddlers, when they have a few, that means they also need to feed you a few, right? Like it's like part of the fun is like just they have one and they stick one in your mouth. So, okay, I eat a little bit, but it's a tiny bit of food. I'm not, you know, certainly not panicking about any of those things. Plus, if my daughter tells me to do something, I just do it, even if, you know, there's some ramifications to it. So my thoughts are I would think about how it impacts your sleep. I'm not worried about the insulin resistance stuff as much. But, you know, if you are agnostic about it, if you're like, I don't care, just like, you know, what's a very general plan is like, be digested by the time you go to bed. And so if you're having a snack, you know, maybe it's 2 hours before bed. If you're having a big meal, maybe it's 3 hours before bed. If you are still really digesting food, you will not sleep as well. So that's my advice. Next question. Do you ever have clients try journaling? Absolutely. Any tips/advice? I struggle with a lot of negative self-talk/doubt. Oh, absolutely, a ton. I think having some form of mindfulness practice is important. That mindfulness practice can be something as structured as therapy, right? It can be something as unstructured as an open Word document on your computer that you journal. It could be something semi-structured, like a couple of questions you answer at the end of the day. It can be specific to clients I've worked with, it can be journaling before and after meals or just after meals. Right now I have a client journaling post-meal sensations, just feelings of satisfaction, feelings of satiety that I think can be very helpful. So what I would, my tips/advice is to talk with your client about what they might find meaningful. Meet them where they're at like you do with everything else, because I'll say this, mindfulness practices in general are hard to get people to do. They just, being introspective and thinking about how we feel isn't something everybody wants to do. So find a version of this that you think your client is ready for, and it could be something very low stress. You know, speaking personally about my own mindfulness practices that I've gone through. I've tried every single one of them, you know, even meditating, but meditating and journaling are slightly different. The thing that I've found for myself, again, this is a tangent now. This isn't like a how I help my clients, but something that has really helped me is something I've been doing on and off for years. It's just writing down three good things that happened every day at the end of the day. I think there's something to conditioning your brain to seeing the positives. And I just listened to a good podcast on circadian rhythm on Simon Hill's podcast. If you don't follow Simon Hill or listen to his podcast, it's wonderful. And they talked about the word rumination. It's just like the, ruminating at night about, you know, things in your life, stress, the next day tasks you have to do. And I think for me, two things that have really helped me combat rumination and set myself up mentally for improved sleep and positivity and reflection is twofold. One is making a to-do list. And Simon mentions sort of a visualization tactic of taking that metaphorical to-do list and putting it up into a bookshelf, right? And just visualize putting it away into the next day. I think something like that, whether it's thinking about stuff and visualizing or physically doing it. I've been physically making to-do lists forever. I find that to be an incredible end of the night routine to wind down. But the second thing is writing down three good things that happened that day. And the best part of that is what you write when days are shitty, right? So like, you know, whatever, this is not therapy and I've just gone off the rails on this question here already, but I've been struggling with a bit more stress lately than normal over the past couple of weeks. Hilariously, we have had amazing weather in New Jersey the last couple of days. I'm sure if you're in the Northeast, there's a heat wave, and it might be the whole country. You know, I saw the LA Marathon had like crazy heat wave, whatever, but it was like 40, 40, 40, 40. And then we've had 4 days of 70 and sunny, and it's just been the best. We've had the best days with my daughter at the park. And I looked at Jen, and I was like, I don't know if I've been stressed or I've just had seasonal affective disorder. Like, have I been stressed or just depressed that I haven't seen the sun in a few months? Like, cause I was like, I feel great. So yeah, anyway, long story short, I think journaling, some sort of mindfulness practice is good, but I would meet the client where they're at, give a few options that might require different levels of work, right? So like writing a paragraph down per day might be a lot for somebody, but starting with writing down three good things, or maybe just like a simple checklist post meal of how satiated somebody feels or satisfied or, you know, what they're feeling more of an open-ended perspective. I think those can be good ins for people into starting to think more and feel more and think about how they feel more. So hopefully there was something helpful in that large ramble. Next question. I have a lot of cardio questions. Basically, just making sure I'm getting the health benefits the way that I'm going about it. And that is, I typically only do 20 to 30 minutes at a time, no matter the modality. Maybe I'll work up to more eventually. I'm going to check if there's another part of that. Nope. All right, let me read it again. I'm going about it, and that is, I typically only do 20 to 30 minutes at a time, no matter the modality. You know, I've said this before, but it's context and the words you use are important. So if you said to me, hey, I'm doing 20 to 30 minutes at a time, four times a week, you know, I don't know how many times a week you're doing it. I don't know how difficult those things are, how challenging those things are. What I would say is if you're doing this a few times a week and it's semi-challenging, like you're doing awesome and you are largely checking a lot of the cardiovascular exercise-related health benefits. Are you fully 100% maximizing? No, you're not. You're not. You know, but I hope that's not what people are asking. Like, you're not, no one listening to this podcast is actually trying to maximize. Maximization requires exponential work for exponentially more work for exponentially less and less and less benefits. Like, nobody's actually trying to maximize. And that's something, a rant I can go on another time. It's like, if you said, no, you're not maximizing at a couple times a week, 20, 30 minutes. What most people want to hear from me is that they can stop stressing about it and they're doing a pretty darn good job. And that's what most people are doing when they ask me this question. They're doing enough cardio that they can feel good about it. And what I would add is typically what's the delta between what you're doing and some of the low hanging fruit things you could do if you wanted a little bit more benefit. So I don't know exactly what your routine is, or so I can't give you a, hey, but you're doing amazing, but here might be low hanging fruit ways to get a little bit more. But what I would say is if you're doing 20 to 30 minutes, low intensity, right? So like a steady state zone two, a few times a week, 2 to 4 times a week, I think you're doing awesome. If you combine that with lifting and then all the other lifestyle things, I think you can feel really good about your heart health. Would you benefit from more? Yes. Would you benefit uniquely with a sprinkling of higher intensity? Yes. But you can still feel really good about it. And you know, some people would say, well, when I do the higher intensity cardio, I really don't enjoy it. Like I can get on the treadmill and walk on the incline and watch my TV show or jog really slow and watch my TV show or talk on the phone. And that's how I'm going to get my cardio in. Once I'm doing something distressing, like distressingly difficult, I don't like it anymore and I'm not going to do it. Okay. That's like a impossible thing to answer in a Q&A, of course, because that's factoring in your personal preference and what you're going to do. But yeah, maybe again, something in there for you. Next question, we'll do a few more. Why have you been trying to increase your plant protein intake? It's super simple. In basically every study we've ever done, increasing plant protein intake, or more specifically, I'd say swapping out animal protein for plant protein, that's sort of substitution analysis. Well, actually, I don't even want, that's not even fair. Not more importantly, it's both. When we look at large populations, and I have a study coming out with Akash Patel and even the discussion with Andy DeSantis and another discussion with Dr. Matthew Nagra, you know, it's very clear. The more plant protein you eat, the better long-term health outcomes, better reductions in all-cause mortality or specific disease mortality, improved, you know, there's a improved cognitive long-term outcomes. It's, to put it simply, without oversimplifying, I don't want to oversimplify, but more plant protein is linked to better overall health outcomes, maybe more than any single dietary factor. And so increasing plant protein intake is consistently linked to improved health outcomes, especially, or not even especially, but in additionally, when it's substituted in place of animal protein. That doesn't mean animal protein's bad for you, by the way. It just means that when we see people who eat more plant protein, they tend to have better health outcomes. And one of the things I was telling, the podcast with Akash Patel will come out soon. It's a long one. I actually think it's a wonderful podcast. And we took it slow. It wasn't an episode where we rushed through anything. We took it slow. We had a good laugh about some stuff. I really enjoyed chatting with him. He's a super smart kid. I was going to call him a kid, but I guess he's younger than me, so we can call him a kid, but he's a super smart dude. One of the things that's really helped me increase my plant protein intake is actually stopping obsessing over really high protein intakes. Because yes, if you want to eat a gram per pound as a vegan, of course you can do it. Of course. But like most people eating a gram per pound, they're using some sort of supplementation. They're really focusing on kind of leaner, lower calorie, higher protein sources. But this whole ball game of increasing, for me specifically, my legume intake, like most of my plant protein is coming from, well, that's not true, but I'd say a high percentage of it is coming from beans and legumes and lentils. Is by not worrying about getting a gram per pound. Like most people are like, oh, I can't eat beans. They're so high in calories. They're not enough protein. It's because you're trying to eat so much freaking protein. You know, I'm 190 pounds. I used to try and eat like 220 grams of protein. I eat like 130 grams of protein now, which is plenty. First of all, it's more than enough for health and it's more than enough for the physique goals that I have. And by the way, my goals are not just I just want to be healthy. I have slightly more ambitious physique goals than that. And at 130 grams of protein and 190 pounds, like it's not hard at all to get there with beans. I'm not saying only beans, but I'm saying it's not like, oh, once I include beans, it's impossible to hit my protein intake. If you feel that way, you're probably shooting too high in protein or, you know, just other dietary, you know, patterns that you know, engage in are not leading you there. So yeah, plant protein intake consistently linked to better overall health outcomes. And I think most people would find that easier to do if they stopped aiming at such high protein intakes. Next question. Does having more range of motion or mobility get you better gains? No. If so, does that mean training mobility would be beneficial? My reflex is to say no. I think there might be in an extreme case where you lack so much range of motion, it's actually just hard to challenge a muscle. But I think that's more niche case. You know, I think if you have like decent mobility at something, if you have terrible, like if you, let's use your elbow and let's talk about training your bicep. Let's say you can't, you can't get past 90 degrees of elbow flexion. You can't straighten your arm at all. The only bicep, the only kind of arm extension you can do is halfway down and back up, halfway down and back up. Do I think that would limit your ability to maximally train your biceps? Probably. But that's just not most people. And specific to that example, I bet that's almost nobody. But like, you know, if you're like, well, I see that some people can RDL to the point where the plates hit the floor and I can only go down to the middle of my shin. Am I getting less gains? And there's other things that have nothing to do with mobility that will make that more or less likely, specifically even just like the length of your arms. But let's use that as an example. It's like, oh, you know, she gets deeper in her RDLs. Does that mean she's getting more out of them? It's not. You should be using the mobility that you have available to you. In my opinion, you should be using the most range of motion that you have available to you. And that is going to be sufficient for the vast majority of people to get the level of mobility that you need to go about your daily life without a mobility-related issue. Some people don't really like my stance on mobility here. But like, I just feel like it's strawmanned 24/7 here. It's like, if you want to be more mobile and you're already lifting weights with a full range of motion and a variety of movement patterns, if you want to be more mobile, train for being more mobile. I think lifting weights through a full range of motion, and I say full range of motion, I mean a real full range of motion that that maximizes the range of motion you have available to you, is a better use of your time and a box you should check first. That's all. If you want more mobility, go nuts. I think people think mobility training will get them out of pain. I think people think mobility training will, inherently improve their life, and it might. But I also think people need to be real about the level of mobility that they need to perform the tasks that they want to perform in their life. That's all. It's not going to be a mobility tangent, and so I'm gonna cut myself off here. But the answer isn't definitively no, but I think it's practically probably no. Like being able to get deeper in your squat. Again, if you have really bad mobility, I think getting better mobility will improve your gains. I think you'll be able to just lengthen muscles under load more, and I think that there's probably a benefit. But if you have like decent mobility, I don't think getting even better mobility is the key that you're missing to better gains. Let's say it that way. All right, last question. Do you find that you get bloated at all consuming as much fiber as you do? Oh, this is, I love this question, and I'm not coming at you. Person who asked this question, I love you. It's a great question. So the following rant is not coming at you, but being a little bloated or farting, it doesn't mean it's worth it. It's worth it to eat fiber and feel a little bloated sometimes and fart a little bit more. It's worth it. It's worth the health benefits. Being bloated a little bit, farting more does not mean you did something wrong, does not mean it was too much fiber. It's too much fiber if you decide it's too much fiber, right? If you're like, I'm so uncomfortable, I don't want to feel this way, I'm going to start eating a little bit less fiber and maybe I'll work my way up, or maybe you call it quits at a certain point. People are like, well, I don't want to eat so much fiber, I feel bloated. It's like, it's worth it, you know? And people think like bloated means fat gain or that they don't look good. Like, so I get triggered, again, not at the question, but the idea that like people are worried about a little bit of bloating, they're worried. Like a lot of that stuff is just a natural physiological response to eating fiber, and the fermentation of the fiber by your gut bacteria can give off gases. There are several other reasons, but it doesn't mean it's bad, and it's almost 100% of the time worth it. Again, can you feel so bloated and so uncomfortable that it turns you off? Yeah. And if you are someone out there who's looking to increase your fiber, is doing that gradually and making sure you stay hydrated, are those good ideas? I think they are good ideas, because I want people to reduce their discomfort, because I know that if people are less uncomfortable, they'll be more likely to do the thing. So I still recommend that you increase your fiber gradually so you're less uncomfortable, so you're more likely to do it. So your question, do I ever feel bloated? Yes, sometimes. Do I have gas? Yep, sometimes. I'm eating like 70 to 80 grams of fiber per day. And by the way, PS, my total calorie intake is probably higher than yours. And so that number is more like 20 grams per 1,000 calories, right? So maybe I'm in the 3 to 4,000 calories. So I'm in that like 60 to 80 grams of fiber. And so when you put it that way, it's actually not insane. I know that sounds like a lot, but again, if you're eating 2,000 calories, we look at something like 15 grams of fiber per 1,000 calories as the target. I eat a little bit more than that, and then I eat more calories than most. And so that number in absolute goes, you know, a bit higher. But I'm just not worried about it. If I'm a little bloated, I'm not coming at you, question asker, because you might not be so worried about it. You just asked me a question, so no worries. But I don't want that to be a barrier for people who eat fiber. You know, people are like, I eat fiber, I fart. It's like, yeah, I know. That's what happens. You're like, oh, I get a little bloated. It's like, yeah, you get a little bloated for a little while and then it goes away. And guess what? You live longer, your cholesterol's better, you know, you're more full, you get more phyto and micronutrients. Like, so I'll die on that hill of like people are too worried about a little bit of bloating and a little bit of gas, and it's stopping them from doing something that's ultimately really, really healthy for them. All right. I will end on that note now that my heart rate is up a little bit. So thank you to everybody who asked a question. I will see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.